We are going to discuss this hour the public outcry that followed what many considered a light sentence for a former Stanford University athlete convicted of felony sexual assault. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 and a half minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, June 10th. We will welcome your thoughts and questions on this case and on the efforts to change rape culture on college campuses and in society in general, for that matter. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Aaron Thornley Parisi is the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you for being with us. So, former Stanford University athlete, swimmer Brock Turner, received a six-month jail sentence for this conviction of felony sexual assault, but it turns out it probably will be closer to 3 months in jail, not 6 months. He had been convicted of a felony sexual assault for sexually assaulting an intoxicated, unconscious woman following a party. The prosecutors had asked for Turner to be sentenced to 6 years in prison. Tell me your reaction to this sentence.
Well, I was as shocked as everybody else in that, but not as shocked as one would think, simply because it's not that unusual. The fact that, you know, it was prosecuted in the first place, you know, was a good thing because, you know, over 90% of cases aren't. And so I think that it's the fact that, you know, this was such a slap in the face to all victims of sexual assault that that made this so horrifying. And the fact that, you know, this is yet another athlete who his career was put ahead of the horror of the crime that he committed.
Yeah, critics of the sentence suggested that Turner was given a less severe sentence because of his aspirations for the Olympics and his private school background. I think the judge actually said Turner was young, he had a lack of criminal history, and that a prison sentence would have a severe impact on him. What do you have to say about that?
I think it's interesting because that's something that we commonly talk about as a severe impact on the perpetrator. And it really speaks to how we have culturally accepted sexual assault as inevitable, as something that is the victim's fault, and we have downplayed the impact on victims so much that we've just become blind to that impact, and, you know, blind to what this does to a person's life, and we continue to kind of work around that and really support perpetrators through the system, through the media, far more than we support victims.
Yeah. A reaction on Facebook, a lot of it already. Kathy on Facebook says, most prominent example of white male privilege that I have seen yet. What do you make of that comment?
I think that's probably true. And I have said before that, you know, the fact that he's white and this is a prestigious school, that he had this, you know, so-called, you know, or promising career, I think all of that factored into it. That's, you know, that's fairly common. That the courts will look more favorably on somebody who has the profile that he has, and yeah, it is definitely white male privilege here.
Some are pointing to the judge saying, if I'm not mistaken, the judge is graduated himself from Stanford University. There is a petition to now get him off the bench. Do you think this judge is in trouble for this sentence?
Possibly, and I think it's actually a very interesting strategy to start to hammer away at this issue, because this is going to take multiple strategies. It's going to take everything from people protesting in the streets to recalling judges, and everything in between. That there's a lot of education that needs to take place, and we need to just start taking this issue seriously and realizing that we have a real problem in our country. And we hold ourselves to this, you know, high esteem that we're not like other countries that are so barbaric in their treatment of women. We are like those countries. We may not have these laws that dictate, prohibiting us from alcohol or how we dress or curfews, but we certainly have unwritten rules. And we are all, every woman is raised with those rules, knowing that if we violate any of these rules, and we are sexually assaulted because we asked for it, because we violated the rules, so we will be held accountable for that. So I think it's a great part of the strategy to think about possibly, recalling or just making sure that somebody runs against this judge.
Turner's father wrote a letter detailing his son's difficulty in dealing with this court case. He said his son, in essence, said that his son's life has been changed forever because of 20 minutes of action that night. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I think that it was those were really poorly chosen words. I know that he has clarified that he was just talking about a 20 minute time period, and he wasn't talking about the action, or he says he wasn't talking about the action as in the sexual assault, but they have been walking back a lot of their statements. They have been doing things, both the father and the son have been doing things, saying things, and then later changing, try to change history in their words. And so who knows what his actual intent was with that. But the important part is that, again, it downplayed, the impact on the victim. And that's something that that maybe we just don't want to think about, or we just can't fathom until it happens to us. But the truth is that sexual assault is such an it's just incorporated into women's lives, and many of us have been sexually assaulted. One out of five women are sexually assaulted. One out of four on UW campus. So we have to take those 20 minutes and kind of, luckily Emily Doe really broke it down for us in her statement, but we do have to do that. We have to go through those steps and say, let's really think about what is happening here.
Yeah.
And I don't care about Brock Turner's life. I wish I could. I understand that he may have been a nice guy before, and he may do nice things again, but he's a rapist. And he needs to be held accountable. And so far, he really hasn't been. And he's never admitted that he is a rapist.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the victim's letter. She wrote a powerful statement detailing her perspective of the events. She said that her life has been on hold for over a year of anger, anguish, uncertainty. Can you describe some of the emotional aftermath that she might be going through, or what a rape victim goes through?
Mm-hmm. Well, she did that beautifully. But it is true that as a rape victim, you go through an array of emotions every single day. I actually just read something that a local blogger wrote, and she wrote a beautiful piece about being triggered by this and other events, and how you live with this constant triggering of the events of your sexual assault. And she said that, if I could just read it for a second, it's only one little paragraph.
Sure.
It just says, "I am not brave or broken. I am both. I'm not a survivor or a victim. I am both. I'm not suffering or thriving. I am both. There are moments for all of us of it that I steady myself and I keep walking through the triggers." And I think that was written by Sarah Alvarado, and she did say that I could,
share that.
Let everybody know that she wrote that. And that's the thing that people have to realize, is that this doesn't go away. And at the Rape Crisis Center, what we try to do is help victims, survivors of sexual assault incorporate the experiences into their life in as healthy of a manner as possible. Because there is grief of the life you had before you were sexually assaulted. There is reliving the sexual assault over and over again. There are feelings of shame, feelings of guilt for being in the wrong place, doing the wrong thing, according to how society looks at us.
Let me jump in, Erin Thornley Parisi. She is the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison, talking with us about this Stanford University rape case, and we will talk more about it after we check the latest news. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about the public outcry, the public outrage that has followed the what many considered lenient sentence for a former Stanford University athlete who was convicted of felony sexual assault. We're talking about this case and the issues that it raises, and we are welcoming your reactions and your questions. What would you like to see happen now? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Talking with Erin Thornley Parisi, the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison. Carol on Facebook says about this case and Brock Turner, the defendant. He violated a woman and he got a slap on the wrist because he's white and educated. The judicial system violated the same woman by the questioning from the defense attorney as well as the judge giving out the sentence. No wonder only 30% of victims report their rape. During the trial, Turner's defense attorney attempted to discredit the victim, highlighting her memory loss, saying she was a drunk, flirting, questioning her promiscuity, her personal character. Talk some about how common it is for rape victims to be questioned like that or treated like that.
Yeah, it's extremely common. I mean, that's just a regular part of what we do at the Rape Crisis Center and what places like ours do across the country. Is you spend a lot of time, as does the DA's office, kind of preparing victims for this type of assault, and because it's going to start right away, even it's going to feel like that even from when police start to ask some questions, because the police are trying to get the whole story, and they'll ask some questions that can seem really invasive, and so we start working as a victim advocate immediately with that victim, and then we start preparing them if they are going to enter into the judicial system to be prepared to go through an assault all over again and an assault on their character as well.
Is it true that only about 30% of victims will report their rape?
I think that's actually high. I think that it's fewer than that, but you can see why. People just, most victims do know the perpetrator, and we have done such a good job in society of making sure that women know that they know that we're responsible when we are sexually assaulted, that victims go through just this whole questioning of, was it my fault? Did I do something wrong? That's probably the most common thing that people say when they call the helpline is, I'm not sure if I was sexually assaulted. And then they will often talk about how I was drinking, I went to his place. All of these things that are not it shouldn't lead to being sexually assaulted, but we've conditioned women to think that it is our fault if we if we do that.
We had a caller who just dropped off, who I was going to go to, because he was questioning. Well, if she was intoxicated, and how do we know she didn't say yes? That was his question. And I think the defense was saying that, I don't know, she indicated that she was not objecting by rubbing Brock Turner's back at one point or something along those lines. What about this, you know, there was they were both intoxicated, and if she doesn't remember, maybe she did say yes as the question.
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, that wouldn't fly. You know, sexual assault is unwanted sexual contact or activity, and in order to show that you want it, you have to be conscious. You have to be not be heavily intoxicated. So there was just no way that she was able to consent to this.
Yeah, and there was actually he was going to say there were no witnesses. There actually were at least two witnesses who stumbled upon this and saw this happening behind a dumpster. And when they, when they approached, Brock Turner ran away, and the woman was clearly unconscious at the time.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that you know the defense attorneys are doing their job, and so, and I understand that, but so it is their job to start attacking the woman. It is their job to start, you know, trying to protect their, or for them to protect the person that they were hired to defend. But what's alarming is that they're believed that they get by with it. And I think that's the important thing to remember, is that, you know, yeah, they're, you know, I don't appreciate what they're doing as defense attorneys, and, you know, when it comes to working with, you know, protecting the rights of a sex offender, of a rapist, especially knowing that I don't think it was the case in this particular case, but, you know, offenders will rape between like 6 and 20 times before they're caught, and attorneys will know this. But what's alarming is that as society, we buy into this, you know, that we don't say, oh, that's, you know, he's just, you know, they're just defending their client. We say, oh, you know, maybe he's got a, you know, maybe they have a point here. She was drinking. And we try to just continuously just chip away at the victim. Yeah. And say, you know, this cannot be true, that this swimmer, you know, betrayed all of his friends and betrayed everybody, his family, his, you know, his people, his friends, but he betrayed this woman. But yeah, we're looking at it all from his point of view, and yeah, and we continue to just ignore the impact on Emily Doe.
Yeah, there we had a Facebook comment earlier that has since been deleted. Again, listeners who are rethinking things, but she said that she thought that the sentence was too light, that this was horrible. However, she said young women should be careful and not drink so much. And what about that? I mean, should everybody then went after for blaming the victim? But is it so wrong to say be careful, don't drink so much?
Yeah, well, it is. But, you know, we kind of have to run a parallel track. I mean, I teach my own children this. There's a parallel track of we have to be working to show that sexual assault is not a natural consequence of drinking. Mm-hmm. You know, a hangover is a natural consequence, not sexual assault. But at the same time, we have to be telling women that you know, men will use anything, you know, men who rape will use anything as an excuse to perform that crime, you know, to commit that crime. And so we have to kind of, maneuver around those potential excuses and make sure that we are protected. But as a society, you know, we need to question that, and we're not. We need to say, how ridiculous is it that women, from the time we get up in the morning until the time we go to bed at night, actually long after we're in bed, we are thinking, not, you know, every second, but we have integrated into our lives all of these strategies to protect us from being sexually assaulted. We think about what we wear, what we say. You know, we go to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and think, oh, am I going to come out when it's dark? I better make sure I park under a light. You know, we in the middle of the day, women will just say, oh, I'm working late. I got to go move my car. Everybody knows why they're going to move their car. They're going to move their car to get to a safer place. That should not be normal behavior, but it has become normal behavior for women, and I think that we should have more freedom.
There is a meme or a graphic that is making the rounds where the causes of rape, I think, is what it was, and it had promiscuity, drinking too much, all these other so-called reasons, and then the correct answer was the causes of rape. Is a rapist.
Exactly. Well put. We actually have a bumper sticker that we've put out that says "Don't get raped," and then it's crossed out and it just says "Don't rape," because the different letters are crossed out because that's the thing, is that we keep on just chipping away at this by attacking the victim and talking about all these ways that victims can keep from being raped. But it is a very simple answer. If somebody doesn't consent to sexual contact, don't do it. Yeah. As simple as that, just don't do it. And there is there's this idea that boys and men can't control themselves. And if you break that down, that's simply not true. I mean, we go to, swimming pools and women walk around in bathing suits, and there's not just this random, gang rapes hanging, happening all over the place. Yeah. I mean, women can get dressed in front of their husbands in the morning and not be raped before they go to work in the morning. Men can control themselves. It's that a lot of them are just choosing not to.
Let's go to the phones. Heather in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Yes, what do you think?
I think sexual assault and rape is all too common among women, and they don't report it as it is. And now with this case coming out, I think he should be held responsible more than in the past. And I feel sorry for women now because they didn't report, being assaulted before. And now they have to go through the trial and all the emotional stress and be badgered. And, what's the point in even doing all that when he's just going to get, a slap on the wrist?
Erin, do you fear that this case will discourage even more so women from coming forward after a sexual assault?
I think that if the case had not gotten the attention that it has, that was my initial fear. It's always our fear that that people won't report. However, at the Rape Crisis Center, we don't care if they report. It is up to the victim to decide what she or he wants to do. It's so important that they feel empowered. But reporting to law enforcement officer will help us get the bad guy, and we do want to get the bad guy so that he doesn't rape any more people. Again, then that puts it all on that particular victim. It's like, okay, to protect the next victim, I need to go through this, and so women kind of stand in solidarity with one another in that, I have to do this to protect somebody else. Yeah. And I have to go through this assault again in order to stop it from happening to somebody else. And that's pretty sad as well.
What would be justice for Emily Doe, or what really can happen now that the sentence has been handed down? Can anything change?
Yeah, I hope that it will. I mean, I think that, first of all, that people, because of the victim impact statement that Emily wrote that has gone so viral, I think that that is going to really help break it down for people what it feels like to be sexually assaulted, and I think that that's going to be helpful. I think that, men are as outraged about this as women are, men who don't rape. And I think that's really important. And I think the judges are going to say, people get pretty angry about this. This is something that's not acceptable. So hopefully they're going to be a little bit more aggressive in their charges as well, or in their handing down their sentences. But there is a bigger picture here that needs to take place. There are lots and lots of pieces to this. I mean, law enforcement have to be, you know, they have to have the resources. They have to have the training. The DA's office. DA's offices across Wisconsin are extremely underfunded. And they just don't have the staff that they need to be able to aggressively prosecute all of the cases that come before them. Sexual assault programs are underfunded, under-resourced, and we need to be able to have all of the resources that we need to take care of this. This is going to take a large-scale effort with all of the partners in the community really working together.
Next, we go to Randy in Madison. Hello, Randy.
Good morning. We live in the world of inequality, and I don't think it's ever more savage than in rape cases. I've been reading a little bit about Roman Polanski's rape case, and one of the things that has struck me, as it struck me here in this case, is that maybe we should rethink the anonymity of the rape victim. In other words, sometimes when we get to see, you know, like the life of this this rapist, and you know everything he could lose with the Olympics and that, and the relative anonymity of the victim. Fortunately, that you know she's exposed some of herself, but. Thing is, if they are non-entities, I think you're always going to have that inequality. And I wonder if there's no way of gently changing that whole pattern.
You think there'd be more justice for rape victims if they were not anonymous, Randy?
If they were three-dimensional human beings, yes.
Yeah. Aaron?
I think that's interesting. It's an interesting point. I can't say that I would advocate for it until society stops villainizing victims.
Yeah.
And that's what would have to take place. But I love his point about three-dimensional, because that's the thing, is that women are not three-dimensional. In general, we are not treated as three-dimensional as human beings.
Yeah.
It just across everything, from equality and pay to sexual violence and domestic violence, and all of those factors play in to how we hold people accountable and who we hold accountable for sexual assault.
Let's go next to Miranda in Madison. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Joy.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. So I wanted to bring in a pop culture commentary on this topic, which is from Amy Schumer. And at one point in one of her stand-up performances, she said the statement, you know, every girl has been a little bit raped. And to me, that was just so striking, because when I thought about my own case, I was like, I feel like that is true. Like, the lines of consent are blurred so much that it's possible for someone to wake up in the morning and be like, that wasn't totally consensual, yet still be uncomfortable with framing it as rape. Okay. And I will take the answer off the air.
Yeah, reaction to that, Aaron?
That is well said. I think that happens a lot. And again, it's because rape is so acceptable, because sexual assault has just been accepted and integrated into our lives, that men are free to do what they want with a woman's body. And so, again, women are always questioning ourselves. And you can bet in all of those cases that, you know, the men don't wake up in the morning and say, maybe that wasn't consensual. It's always, the burden is always put on the victim.
We are talking with Aaron Thornley Parisi, who is the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison, about the case involving the former Stanford University athlete who was convicted of felony sexual assault but sentenced to just 6 months in jail. Actually, will probably only serve about 3 months, sparking a national outrage. We're wondering what you think. What was your reaction? What do we need to do now? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are are getting reaction to the Stanford swimmer rape sentence and talking about how we can change attitudes, how we can change the rape culture in our society and on college campuses. We're welcoming your reactions, your questions, your thoughts about this at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. There was a massive outcry that followed a judge sentencing this former Stanford University student, Brock Turner, to a six-month jail sentence for, I think it was three felony sexual assault counts. We did have Aaron Thornley Parisi as our guest, executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison. Elise from Madison said, "My understanding is that he, Brock Turner, is also now a registered sex offender for the rest of his life. That should be included in the facts to make it accurate and fair." So that, I guess she's saying that that's not diddly squat. That's a big deal.
Yes, it is. And I think that is important because it will impact his life. But it certainly is fair, because it, you know, as much as we, you know, like to, you know, say that this boy just couldn't have done this, and his friends have said, you know, they've actually said it wasn't rape at all. It was, and he needs to not do this again. So people do need to know that he's a sex offender.
Yeah, we had another a caller, Greg, who just wanted to know, did the defendant apologize? In Turner's courtroom statement, he repeatedly blamed alcohol and peer pressure and sexual promiscuity for his actions, but I don't think he necessarily took responsibility for sexual assault. Do you know, Aaron?
He did not. That has been a big part of this. That is that you know, I know at the Rape Crisis Center we've been talking about a lot is that you know, when some of his friends said, you know, wouldn't it be better if he could go out and talk to people and go out and, you know, around to colleges and talk about the perils of alcohol and promiscuity. You know, those words right there are really defining what we like to say about sexual assault, especially on campuses. Again, this is saying that this is nothing more than somebody having sex. And he has continued to basically deny the fact that he raped her.
Let's go to James in Waukesha now. Hi, James.
Hi. I have a couple things to say. First is, do you lock your door when you leave your house?
Go ahead with your statement, James. I don't, you know, so yes, I do, but go ahead.
Okay, so, like, we lock our doors because people will steal things. And I think even, like, a year ago you got your purse stolen from your office or something.
Yeah, I did that, and that still happens, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, people steal stuff, but people know that stealing is wrong, but thieves still exist. So the comment that your guest made earlier was that we shouldn't be focusing on the victim to prevent rapes. We should focus on the people. I think generally people know that rape is wrong and not to do it, but we're still people. It still happens. There's still crappy people out there that do this. So I think that it would be inappropriate to just totally not focus on having the victim defend themselves. Another huge thing.
So what do you think ought to be done, James, in terms of teach women self-defense or what?
But just, self-defense, ways to prevent people from raping them, not putting themselves in bad situations. But it's like you said, you know, I'm not trying to say it's the victim's fault. It's not. But we lock our doors to prevent thieves from stealing stuff. We should, women should know that some men can rape them and be ready for it.
Aaron, what do you say to that?
Well, I understand his point, but what's interesting is that that's not getting inside the head of most women who think that, you know, I don't care if my car is stolen. I just want to make sure that my children are not inside it and that I'm not inside it because I will be raped. And most women lock their doors at night, and it's not to keep our stuff safe. It's to keep the people in the house safe. Because it is so common for rape to be kind of a tag tag on to other crimes. You know, it's almost as if, you know, a man will come in and you know, to rob your house and say, ah, there's a woman there, I might as well rape her. It's just such a common part of other crimes that I think that, you know, that's another thing that people that men don't think about is how much women have to think about this.
Yeah. Let's go next to Sarah in Madison. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Yes. What are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, I think so far I haven't heard, I didn't hear the whole program, but I'm wondering what can be done in the future, either for this particular judge or other judges, to really help them understand that sentences this low are very inappropriate, that they're wrong. Is there something that could be done, some sort of a, I don't know, write-in campaign or something to, you know, take this judge out of office or out of a judgeship? I guess I would just like to address that a little bit. It's yet, you know, the sentence was wrong. At least the sentence happened, but it was a very inappropriately low sentence. Of what could be done to prevent that in the future?
Yeah, there is a petition. We touched on it a little bit earlier to recall Judge Aaron Persky, who handed down this sentence. But what about? You think that's going to be enough to inform judges that a light sentence is not going to be tolerated, Aaron?
I think that this probably will go further than other actions have in the past. There is judicial training. We have prosecutor training. We have all kinds of training that goes on. But what we have to remember is that judges are people, and because so many are men, that they are conditioned and they are raised to feel that most sexual assault is not a big deal. You know, kind of speaking to the last caller who was talking about, we all know sexual assault is bad. That I don't think that's necessarily true. We know that sexually assaulting somebody and committing another crime at the same time, such as strangling that person or knocking them unconscious or something like that, and we know that if it's a stranger, that it's bad. We're all fairly clear on that. But what we are not clear on is the average sexual assault that happens on a daily basis, actually every 107 seconds in this country, where it is, you know, a woman is sexually violated and by somebody that she knows.
Yeah, and yeah, you know, date rape and even spousal rape, or you know, hey, she went out, she came up to my room, so I guess she was asking for it, that kind of thing.
Exactly, and I think it's also important to understand that it, in many of those cases, it's not somebody that is well known. This was such a typical case in the fact that you know, Brock Turner, you know, like they could claim or he could claim that we knew each other because we were talking earlier in the evening, and it's also the case that, as hard as this is to hear, there are many men who are grooming women throughout the week in on campuses to get them to a party that weekend so that they can get them drunk and have sex with that woman, which means that they would be sexually assaulting her because she is not conscious and can't make decisions. So this is well thought out, and they may spend a week getting to know that woman for the purpose of sexually assaulting her, a grooming process very similar to one of pedophiles grooming a child.
John in Appleton is with us now. Hi, John.
Hi. I just, you know, one thing I was thinking through this whole thing, and I've been following this, and I got to say thanks to you guys for really shedding a lot of light on this conversation this morning, but would this not be a perfect example of this judge's ruling to remove judicial discretion and create mandatory minimum prison sentences for rapists? Because in my opinion, there's no circumstance in which it's acceptable, no circumstance in which a lesser sentence should be given. And I'm not about removing judicial discretion at any point, usually, but this is something where it happens too often, where people walk, where there are unequal sentences for people who commit these rapes, often based upon racial, the race of the accused. So I was just wondering if there's been any kind of movement for a mandatory minimum sentence in courts or on the state. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Aaron.
It certainly has been discussed over the years, but I don't think that that's that there's any movement towards that. But what I like about this idea is that it's taking sexual assault seriously, and I really appreciate those comments. Yeah.
Judy in Grays Lake is with us now. Hi, Judy.
Hi. My question is about whether there is a civil suit to have monetary charges against the perpetrator. And also I'm wondering, he will be going to jail, but has he been expelled from Stanford, or is that not part? I don't know.
I'm pretty sure he has been. I think they did expel him. But what about, do we know if, I mean, maybe it's up to the, Emily Doe if she wants to file a civil suit, right, Aaron?
Exactly. And I've not heard anything about that. I mean, I think at this point, she may be encouraged to do that by a lot of people, but that I don't think that that's the direction that she has taken publicly at this point. I don't think he was expelled. I think he dropped out.
Oh, okay. I thought Stanford was claiming that, hey, we kicked him out, but maybe I read that wrong.
I think that I think that after 2 weeks they kicked him off. Said you can't be on campus, but I think that's different from expelling him from school.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
We have just a minute to go, and lots of questions and comments still. I don't know. Are you hopeful that this case will lead to any significant changes regarding our rape culture, for a lack of a better phrase?
Yeah, I am hopeful, and I think the fact that Vice President Biden has been has been tweeting about this and has issued a public statement just to Emily Doe about his outrage over this, and that the White House has been taking action over the past couple of years to talk about sexual assault, and they've actually been funding more programs that will take action. I mean, I think that we are at a time in history where we are starting to take this seriously, and this case, so unfortunate for Emily Doe, but I think this case is going to highlight some of that.
Thank you so much for being with us. Aaron Parisi is Thornley Parisi is the executive director of the Rape Crisis Center in Madison.